We've been doing a lot on the roundtable this month to talk about National Poetry Month. And this being the last day of National Poetry Month, we thought we would, well, go out with a bang. So we are going to have a lovely discussion over the next 20 minutes or so about, well, arguably one of the best, Walter Walt Whitman. Born 1819 and died 120 years ago, was an American poet, essayist, and journalist. And we are going to talk about his legacy as well as his work specifically. We have two incredible guests with us. Of course, our own in-house poet, Paul Elisha, joins us. He is the author of the wonderful collection Swash, and it's always a pleasure to have Paul on the program. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Good morning to you, Joe.
Good morning. Jay Rogoff is here as well. He's the author of four books of poetry, most recently The Art of Gravity, a collection of poems about dance, published by Louisiana State University Press. He is a Saratogian and teaches English at Skidmore College in Saratoga, and it's always a pleasure to have Jay on the program. Jay,
it's
thank you very much.
Back here. Great to be back here, Joe. Thank you.
Well, thank you. What makes Whitman Whitman, in your opinion? What is it so special about this guy?
Paul, do you want to start with that, since you've been fulminating about Whitman for a long time?
Well, I came across Whitman at a very early age,
right. And
got most of what young kids get, oh, Captain, my Captain, and
right. That
sort of thing. But the longer I looked at him and the more I read of him, the more I got the sense that Whitman was the first real American revolutionary in the area of writing. I mean, he really cut us loose from the British school and said, from here on in, we've got our own rules. And they were very American rules because they were the I-me rules. It's what I believe, and I have a right to say what I believe in the way that I want to say it. And Jay and I, of course, were discussing this before we came in the studio here about...
Oh, you put poets together and look what happens.
we talk poetry, right.
No, but it's the way he expressed himself with new rules. And he said, my rules are as valid as anybody else's, and so are yours.
Is that a stridency, Jay?
I don't think it's a stridency because one of the experiences you have when you're reading Whitman is that you feel as though you're bathing in him. I mean, the poetry is so large and so engulfing because he's putting himself up not as a counterexample to everything that's come before, but in a way that I think unifies the American experience. He's a revolutionary in a couple of ways. He attempts to democratize poetry. So poetry can be about the self, himself. He is getting that from the English Romantics, from Wordsworth in particular. But it's a self that also incorporates all America.
Right.
So that he decides he's going to write about how people work, and he writes a song for occupations, and then he lists every occupation he can think of, and he shows people at work in detail. He incorporates the sounds and the rhythms of everyday speech, along with some very self-consciously bardic effects that he gets as well. So you hear things that people would say every day, and you hear things that nobody ever thought of saying. He would throw in phrases like the blab of the pave to talk about the everyday speech that comes up on the sidewalk. And his poetry also presents him and the self as an organic thing. It's not a book. It's not an object in cold type, although, of course, we have print on the page. But it's really a living, breathing organism. He calls his first book Leaves of Grass. And his last book is called Leaves of Grass. It's a book that he keeps revising all throughout his life, all throughout his career. It springs from American soil. Its poetry is an organic function of the body. Heartbeats, blood, breath are all very important. And Leaves of Grass is an entity, an organic entity that keeps growing and growing and growing from 1855 until his death.
And the other thing that he did that I think was really courageous. He went he went into the war looking for his brother.
The Civil War we're talking about.
The Civil War.
The great crisis in Whitman's life as well as in the nation's
life. Right. And he found his brother in a hospital in D.C. But until that actually happened, he found himself looking at literally hundreds and hundreds of wounded and dying men from both sides. And he began asking these questions like, why are we doing this? Why are the people who are sending these people off to die doing it? And what is the price that we're paying? And he rubbed our noses in it.
It seems as though, like any good revolutionary, when the work came out, and as you said, Leaves of Grass was this work in progress over the course of his lifetime, course of his working occupational life, but controversial. It came with great great controversy at the time.
Yeah.
But then ended up being so influential to us over the century and the quarter that followed.
Yeah. Well, because he looks at things so closely and so fiercely, he was, he did not shrink from sexuality. And of course, he was at times accused of being a pornographer. When the first editions of his of Leaves of Grass were published in England, they were expurgated. There were certain passages that were taken out. And every once in a while, even Whitman would expurgate himself. In later editions, there were things taken out that aren't in some of the earlier. But for example, there's a famous passage in Song of Myself that has to do with female sexuality. And you just didn't write about female sexuality in the way that Whitman does. I mean, I'll read it. This is section 11. It's a famous section if you know Whitman at all. 28 young men bathe by the shore. 28 young men and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides handsome and richly dressed aft the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs. Their white bellies bulge to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. And it's a remarkable passage because, first of all, we're talking about the fact that women have sexual desire, that women have sexual fantasies, that this young woman who actually in Whitman's time would be seen as on the verge of spinsterhood, she's 28 after all, she's not married, she's hiding in the house, she spies on them, she's a voyeur. And Whitman, the eye, I see you, lady, is also spying on her, and he's spying on the young men as well. So there's an appreciation here for the sexuality of men and men, as well as men and women. We are invited to be voyeurs along with Whitman, and we're also asked to find this as an enriching process, as something that's spiritually regenerative. Yeah. It's really quite amazing.
And yet, at the same time, what he's also doing is saying, for the first time, as every American does, it's my business.
Hmm.
Don't come into my bedroom.
Right.
You know.
Right.
What I do in my bedroom is my affair.
This is something worthy for me to write about.
Yeah.
But
to share. But then.
But don't look any further.
Yeah. Right.
Then, right. Then move on.
And let me right. have my life. Let me have my private life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Walt Whitman this morning as we close out National Poetry Month. Jay Rogoff and Paul Elisha join us in our discussion. We will continue and hear more poetry and have more discussion after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Paul Rich & Sons Home Furnishings and Design, downtown Pittsfield. Furniture, oriental rugs, mattresses, and interior design for living inside and out. Delivery throughout the Northeast, paulrich.com. And the Pilates Principal, Loudonville, New York, offering core strengthening, stretching, and golf and tennis cross training on Pilates exercise equipment, lathampilates.com.
We're talking about Walt Whitman on the roundtable this morning. Jay Rogoff is with us, a professor of English at Skidmore College and a published poet. Paul Elisha also joins us, our poet in residence here at WAMC and author of the wonderful poetry collection Swash. And it's a great pleasure to have both gentlemen before our microphones on this final day of National Poetry Month. One of the things that you often hear about Whitman of being the father of free verse, is that real, imagined, warranted?
Well, free verse, let's see. There is free verse earlier, certainly. Blake is writing it. Christopher Smart is writing it, although it's not published, so Whitman would not have known it. Whitman may have known Blake. I'm not quite sure. And of course, there are the rhythms.
Wordsworth, he did know.
Right. That would be blank verse. The thing about Whitman and Wordsworth is that Wordsworth is writing in a very orderly fashion about the development of his own mind, the prelude. That's what that's all about. Mm. Whitman would have known that, but Leaves of Grass is, by comparison, very disorderly. It's really all over the place. It has an emotional map rather than a logical map. And of course, the other place where Whitman would have gotten free verse was in the rhythms of the King James Bible. And that is something that comes very, very influential to him. And it's almost as though he's writing a kind of alternative Bible of America and the self.
Right. But what I was going to bring up here has to do with the fact that he said it was okay. It was okay to do free verse. Mm-hmm. And it was still okay to do rhyme if you wanted mm-hmm. to.
And the thing that's amazing is that he demonstrates this at the very beginning of Song of Myself. Mm-hmm. The first line of Song of Myself, "I celebrate myself and sing myself." If you've been trained in poetry, you hear that instantly. It's an iambic pentameter.
Right.
We're in the meter of Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth. But then he leaves it. "I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass."
Mm. And yet, he could also do things like, "Oh, Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done."
Right, you know? Right.
Or "When lilacs last in the dooryard bloom."
Oh, gorgeous, gorgeous. And, you know, and the second part of Song of Myself, the second little section, Song of Myself is part of Leaves of Grass, divided into many sections. It begins, "Houses and rooms are full of perfumes." I mean, this is Victorian parlor verse.
Right.
And then he drops it. So it's
Susian.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Exactly.
Right. One of my great poetic influences. "Houses and rooms are full of perfumes," and then he goes, "The shelves are crowded with perfumes. I breathe the fragrance myself and know it and like it. The distillation would intoxicate me also, but I shall not let it." Hmm. So it's as though the distillation, the perfume of Victorian poetry, of rhyme, of seductive meters, are things that come into Whitman's verse, but he can also live without them, and more often than not, he does discard them.
Paul, I know there was a section that you wanted to share with us this morning.
His response to the enormity of the Civil War. And I just happened to come across this one it's called Responde. And he begins, "Responde, responde. The war is completed. The price is paid. The title is settled beyond recall. Let everyone answer. Let those who sleep be waked. Let none evade. Must we still go on with our affectations and sneaking? Let me bring this to a close. I pronounce openly for a new distribution of roles. And then he goes on, let the murderers, bigots, fools, unclean persons offer new propositions. And then he questions what the cost of all of this and why we did it, either side.
For Whitman, really, one of the worst things that you could do was be divisive. Saw America as a gigantic project, everyone together, and people who opposed North to South, Black to White, Gay to Straight. I mean, these were the forces of evil, anybody who made these kinds of distinctions and separated them.
What he wanted was for people to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there is such a political tone in the work, and as Paul, as you just alluded to and you just mentioned, of how resonant that is today is quite amazing.
Yeah, it's suddenly we're back where we were, looking at how these things occur. How out of loose talk by either side and empty boasts can lead to God knows what kind of conflagration. Mm-hmm. And who pays the price? Whitman, that's the other thing he asks.
I'm sorry. Whitman wrote a little poem. He wrote several poems after Lincoln's death, most famously, "O Captain, My Captain,"
and
Paul's favorite, "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed." But one of the things he wrote was a little four-line poem called "This Dust Was Once the Man." "This dust was once the man, gentle, plain, just, and resolute, under whose cautious hand against the foulest crime in history, known in any land or age, was saved the Union of these states." And I'm reading that not because it's a great poem. I don't think it's a terribly good poem at all. But the idea that for Whitman, the foulest crime in history known in any land or age was not, for example, the crucifixion of Jesus, which another poet might indicate, but the fact that the South broke off and made war against the North, the fact that certain factions saw fit to fight civil war in America.
In the, of course, the Civil War, and of this era, his views on slavery are fascinating,
right?
As well,
he literally comes out, and I can't put my finger on it at the moment. Jay probably can, where he talks about the fact that there should be no such thing as slavery.
Absolutely, he I don't know how active Whitman actually was, but he certainly was abolitionist in spirit.
Yeah.
And he has a passage about a runaway slave coming to his house. Now, scholars think that this is probably fiction, but here it is in Leaves of Grass. And the runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. And this is what Whitman, as the poet says he did, gave him a room that entered from my own and gave him some coarse, clean clothes. And remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles, the wounds from the shackles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next me at table. My firelock leaned in the corner. So Whitman, in the poem, owns a gun, but he doesn't see any need to use it.
Mm-hmm.
He senses no danger from this guy. He's a fellow.
So he calls for the abolition of slavery, but we later see him looking at the abolitionist movement as somewhat of a threat to democracy.
Hmm.
Is that true?
I'm not actually sure about that. That's really something, a threat to democracy in that it's something that pushes division towards the Civil War.
Right.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, that's one of the things I was getting at. That anything that can't be talked out to him is destructive to the country.
something that just makes no sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whitman was a Quaker, so he would have been involved in meeting, and so talking things out is the natural way of negotiating.
Always.
Of dealing with confrontation and disagreement.
I was going to ask you about the impact of being a Quaker, of his spirituality on his poetry. I mean, is that at the very core, or does he challenge it?
Oh, I think that the experiences that he met along the way forced him out of that neutrality. I mean, the reality of some of the stuff he came up against was, I think, so powerful and so moving that it forced him to express himself about it. Beyond what he might have thought if he had just thought about it and not known any of those experiences.
We have about a minute and a half left. Who would like to read? Okay, Jay?
I'll just end with just a little bit of the beginning of Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking, which was a revision on Whitman's part. It began initially out of the rocked cradle, not the beautiful, loving rhythms that we know now. Out of the cradle, endlessly rocking. Out of the mockingbird's throat, the musical shuttle. Out of the ninth month midnight, over the sterile sands and the fields beyond, where the child, leaving his bed, wandered alone, bareheaded, barefoot, down from the showered halo, up from the mystic play of shadows twining and twisting as if they were alive, out from the patches of briars and blackberries, from the memories of the bird that chanted to me, from your memories, sad brother, from the fitful risings and fallings I heard. And then on and on, and he says, finally, a reminiscence, sing. This is his invocation to the muse. It's not anything heavenly or out of this world, but something from the sea, something from the earth, something from the mother.
Jay Rogoff and Paul Elisha are our guests this morning. We've been talking about Walt Whitman on this last day of National Poetry Month. Any listener to this program, regular listener, of course, knows that every month is Poetry Month here on the Roundtable. But
that's true.
We use this as our peg to have a wonderful discussion, and I thank you both for being with us this morning. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you, Jay.
Our
it's a pleasure here, too.
And Paul, we look forward to many bird's eye views in the future. Excellent.
And since Jay has a new book out, we're going to try to get him on that one, too.
You're on record, Jay.
It'll be a great pleasure, really.